President Trump is expected to sign a border security deal to avoid another partial government shutdown. We're getting the latest here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democrats and Republicans formulated a deal late Monday on legislation to fund the government. Then on Tuesday, we learned about this agreement in principle. And yesterday afternoon, the president spoke before top law enforcement officials at a conference in Washington.
As we review the new proposal from Congress, I can promise you this. I will never waver from my sacred duty to defend this nation and its people. We will get the job done. The wall is very, very on its way. It's happening as we speak.
Congress faces a looming deadline to get a deal passed and signed by the president before tomorrow. So let's go right to analysis. Alisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. She joins us from our studios in Superior. Alisa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Well, bring us up to speed. Has this legislation come up for a vote yet in the House and Senate?
It has not yet. It seems as if it's pretty certain that it will pass through the House and the Senate. There's leadership in both that are expressing excitement over this deal, or if it, maybe not quite excitement, but at least acceptance, and are pushing their fellow colleagues to support it. As you mentioned, the president has seemed to indicate that he would be inclined to sign it, although, you know, it's really hard to tell because with the last shutdown, obviously, there was a belief that that budget deal was going to be reached. And then at the last minute, he refused to sign it. So as of right now, it seems as if it will hopefully go through before the deadline tonight, by the deadline tomorrow, excuse me. But it's still, of course, anyone's guess.
Well, let's take a step back. All week, lawmakers have been negotiating on Capitol Hill to craft this compromise legislation on border security funding. What do we know about this legislation?
Well, it is quite a long piece of legislation, so they're still going through it. Especially the White House has expressed that they are carefully combing through the document itself. But it does contain $1.375 billion for improvements of border fencing that are already there, and in some locations they are replacing the fencing. So it's a barrier of sorts, but it is not the concrete or steel wall that the president had argued that was needed. There's also components including the number of detention beds for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. There's just, I mean, a large array of issues, but primarily we seem to be focused in on those border security issues and whether or not that will be acceptable to Republicans, whether or not it'll be acceptable to the president, again, seems to be the key sticking point at this point.
Is this truly a bipartisan compromise? Did either party here have a leg up or, you know, have to give a lot on this deal?
Well, there were compromises certainly that were made on both sides. So the committee that was formed to create this budget deal is composed of Republican and Democratic legislators, leadership, also members whose border or whose district is along that U.S.-Mexico border that we've been focused on so heavily of recent time. And so there is a broad array of members who were involved in this deal, and Republicans certainly gave up some of their primary goals, particularly the president's asking for $5.7 billion for funding. So we certainly do not see that at all. We do not see any money appropriated for anything beyond a fencing or a barrier of that nature. And the Democrats also gave up some of their asks, I suppose. They had wanted much fewer dollars appropriated for ICE detention beds. However, they did negotiate and they agreed upon 40,000.
Detention beds at Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah, the text of this bill, more than 1,100 pages, it was released late yesterday. Yeah. So what happened yesterday in Congress to get this ready for a vote? And this is a lot to get through.
So the primary players involved, the legislators, hashed out the finer points of, you know, those debates that both parties were really holding firm to. And it's been work of aides, of legislators, of, you know, really everybody coming together and ensuring that this is, you know, is put together in full and it contains all the appropriate or all the requirements that are needed for this appropriations.
This is a seven-bill spending package. There's a lot in it. And besides border security has been the central focus of all these discussions. Remind us what other funding is tied up in this legislation.
Well, if we remember what happened during the last shutdown, I guess people probably don't want to revisit that time, but it involved everything from funding for our national parks to remain open. It contained funding for TSA agents at airports, for at the FBI, for many of our different law enforcement agencies, and in particular the Coast Guard would receive funding or will now receive funding under this bill. So all of those stories that we heard during the shutdown of all those individuals who were either furloughed or were working and not getting paid, all of those different agencies and organizations will now hopefully get the funding they need to operate in full. And one other key aspect of the bill that was that held up negotiations for a while was the issue of back pay for federal contractors. So under the last shutdown, all of the individuals, all government workers that were furloughed, that were working without pay, they received back pay for their time off once the government was reopened. However, for all of the government contractors, and there are contractors for, I mean, virtually any agency of the government that, you know, engages in some action, helps, you know, Americans in some fashion, they contract with different private companies. And those organizations, it was unclear whether or not they would get pay after the government resumed. So there is some language or indication in there that that there wasn't any funding for federal contractors in this appropriations bill. However, there are other means to achieve that, I suppose, or the other means to achieve it for those individuals.
We're talking with Elisa von Hagel. She's a political scientist at UW-Superior. We're looking at this border security bill. Elisa, before the government shut down earlier this year, the House and Senate had agreed on a funding bill, but President Trump refused to sign it due to the lack of money for a border wall. Do we anticipate history repeating itself here? And what are the president's options for getting this wall outside of this bill?
Well, I suppose it's not very academic of myself to state that fingers are crossed, but I'm assuming lots of people have fingers crossed, just hoping that it doesn't happen. And so we are at a different place than we were in the last shutdown. The last shutdown, the longest in our history, overwhelmingly Americans see Trump as the, if not the sole individual to blame, as a key driver of that shutdown. And also there is incredibly diminishing support for a barrier, a border fence, or a border wall, even in other types of barriers that have been talked about. So the president doesn't have a lot of political capital to make his claim, to make his argument that this is necessary to protect the nation's security and thus shut down the government again. Other options are available. He's been talking about declaring a national emergency, which would be fairly controversial and certainly would prompt swift reactions by legislators. There's other avenues that have been discussed are utilizing different streams of revenue that are meant for the Army Corps of Engineers or other type organizations. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Elisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to The Ideas Network. It's an industry that thrives on competition and rivalry, but there are good, rewarding jobs to be had. We're talking about building a career in politics on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If you've ever dreamed of working in Congress, we're looking at the steps to get there. The number of congressional staffers hovers around 15,000. What does it take to land one of those jobs? And what are your experiences and questions about building a career in politics? We're at 800-642-1234. Have you made a career out of a local government, or have you held jobs on Capitol Hill? If so, where did it start and how far did you go? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called Climbing the Hill, How to Build a Career in Politics and Make a Difference. And the co-authors join us. Jamie Harrison is Associate Chair and Counselor for the Democratic National Committee. Jamie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Amos Sneed is co-founder of FamousDC.com. Amos, welcome to you.
Hey, Kate, thank you very much for having us this morning.
Well, Amos, let's start with you. You came from small town Alabama, made it to the Hill, and through this book, you seem to take a step-by-step prescriptive approach to landing a job on Capitol Hill. So how hard is it to get a job working for Congress in some capacity?
Well, Kate, I appreciate the question. When Jamie and I set out to write our book, Climbing the Hill, together, that's what we wanted to answer, was how do you get involved? Because when I started my career in Washington, the thing I kept hearing was, well, you can't work on Capitol Hill unless you have Hill experience. And I kept thinking to myself, well, how can I get Hill experience if nobody will give me that first opportunity? So what we've really tried to do in Climbing the Hill is take a step-by-step practitioner's guide how to get involved on the state, local, federal level. And then once you're involved, how to continue making that climb upward.
And Jamie, we should point out that you're a Democrat and Amos, you're a Republican. And despite those differences, you came together to write this book. Jamie, why was it important to have both political sides represented?
Well, listen, in the end of the day, Kate, anybody who wants to go to Capitol Hill really wants to make a difference. Regardless if you're a Democrat or Republican or progressive or conservative, you want to find ways to make life better for the American people. And so Amos and I struck up a friendship. We knew each other while we were on the Hill, but we really didn't become friends until we left the Hill. When Amos invited me to come speak with a group of young kids from South Carolina, and from that time, we thought that we shared this whole idea that we want more people to come to Washington D.C. who can really try to find common ground and make a difference.
Well, Jamie, though, you point out in the book that you come representing a political party, that once you start working for a particular party, that you might not ever jump across the aisle. How does that work?
It is Capitol Hill. I like to say Capitol Hill will make you choose, even if you have not made up in your mind whether you're a Democrat or Republican. It's just the nature of the beast that things are done in a partisan fashion, and even in terms of how the floor operates or how committee assignments are made. They're made based on the party. And so many times you'll have young staffers who will intern. Sometimes they have, you're a Democrat and you live in a Republican state, and so the only Republican members of Congress are Republican. And so you come there. For the longest time, that would be fine, and that's okay, and people still do that today. But it can be very, very difficult to then flip over to the other side just because of the lack of comedy, the lack of trust that's now the heightened partisanship that's in Congress. It makes you choose, and it's hard for you to go over to the other side.
So on its surface, politics might look rather unappealing for some people right now. The federal government was shut down for 35 days. Brinkmanship seems to be the new normal. And we've seen some longtime lawmakers seem to be stepping away, hanging up their hat, and average citizens have been caught up in the shutdown. So Amos, given all of that, is there still a big demand out there for a job in politics, or has it lost its luster?
I think there's always going to be a demand for jobs in politics, especially jobs in Washington and on Capitol Hill. I do think that as partisan as this environment currently is, it is turning a lot of young people away from entering into politics. I mean, if I was 22, 23 years old, coming out of school, 24, and I saw what was happening right now, I may not go into politics. So what Jamie and I are trying to do here, what we tried to come together and do with Climbing the Hill, our book, was show people that once you get to Washington, you can actually work together. You can work together with people on the other side of the aisle. And there's a saying I've always believed in. It's personnel, it's policy. If you want to make a difference in this country, you can, and there is a path to do so. You just have to get involved. And so what we're trying to do with our book is show young people, if you want to get involved, if you want a career in politics, this may not be the perfect roadmap, but this will get you on your journey.
We're talking with Jamie Harrison and Amos Sneed and getting your reflections on a career in government at 800-642-1234. What advice would you offer people who are considering politics as a career? Maybe you're interested in a career change to work in the halls of government. What do you want to know about mid-career transitions? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jamie, some people say it takes a certain kind of person to work in politics, but you make the case that anyone can build a career in government as long as you're willing to work for it and feel like you can make meaningful contributions, as long as you have that public servant attitude. How do you succeed in working in this cutthroat arena?
Well, the first thing is, and the first lesson in our book is, you need to have a dream. There needs to be desire and passion to really affect change, and that's the driving force on Capitol Hill. People have to have some core within them that they want to see or want to make a difference for a group or people, or for you can take any issue, the environment, that they want to make a difference, and that's really where success comes on Capitol Hill. And so that's the thing that we always ask young people. They say, well, I don't know if I want to be on Capitol Hill. And say, well, what's really your passion? What's the thing that really gets you upset or really gets you or that makes you happy when you're doing it? And once you figure that out, then use that as the core and the fuel to really charge up your career options. So that may lead to Capitol Hill. It may not lead to Capitol Hill. You may say, I just don't want to be a part of this craziness. But anyway, many of us find out what that passion is. For me, it was education. And I knew the impact of a quality education on my life and how it transformed my trajectory and allowed me to live the American dream. And so one of the things that I really wanted to do was work on education policy so that more young people, particularly young poor people from the South, because that was my experience, had the opportunity to do the things in life that I've been able to do. And so that's part of the reason why I went to Capitol Hill. And then I realized that I had a whole whole other sets of passions and things that I wanted to accomplish. And but the core of it is you need to have a dream and you need to figure out what is your desire and passion to make a difference.
And Jamie, before we get any further in this, we learned recently that you've formed an exploratory committee to run against Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham in 2020. And so as you make your considerations on your next career move, what questions do you ask yourself? And are these similar to the questions that you write about and ask people as they think about pursuing a career in politics?
Yeah. A few of the things that I'm thinking about in this exploratory committee is, do I have the skills in order to do this, to adequately represent the people in South Carolina that I love so much and so dearly? And can I be an effective advocate for those individuals? Do I have those skill sets in order to effectively advocate for them in Washington, D.C.? I mean, the contest itself is not something that I'm concerning myself with, and that's not the part that I'm exploring. The part that I'm exploring is, can I be an effective representative for those folks? Can I really be a true public servant and focus on serving the people in South Carolina?
Amos,
so many of those questions are, and some answers, I guess, are in our book.
Well, Amos, I was struck by the 10 years on Capitol Hill. The average person working on Capitol Hill is just a decade. A decade is not what a career makes. Why do people leave?
Well, Kate, it's a good point. And most people may not know the average age of a congressional staffer. The average age of a staffer on Capitol Hill is 27 years old. And it usually shocks people when they first come to Capitol Hill and they look around and go, who are all these kids and what are they doing? And you're like, no, they're running it. This is who they are. But I think you bring up a good point. You can't stay on Capitol Hill and live in Washington, D.C. and try to raise a family. You just can't do it. You don't make enough money to do that. What you see are a lot of young people come to Capitol Hill, get involved, and then as Jamie highlighted, they find that passion. For Jamie, that passion was education. So then you start thinking, where do I go from here? How can I continue to make an impact and use the skills and the connections and the relationships I've formed on Capitol Hill to take that to the next chapter? So you see a lot of young people come to Washington in that sort of 22, 23 to 27 years of age, and then go do something else great. And throughout our book, Climbing the Hill, we have snippets of people who've gone on to do really amazing things that started their career on Capitol Hill.
We're looking at the path to jobs in local and state politics on The Morning Show. You can join in 800-642-1234. Amos Sneed, co-founder of FamousDC.com. Jamie Harrison, associate chair and counselor for the Democratic National Committee. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what it takes to build a career in politics, particularly the jobs that aren't the lawmakers. Think the legislative assistants, press secretaries, schedulers. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and the authors of Climbing the Hill write, most Hill careers last fewer than 10 years. The first one is almost always lucky because of how hard the job is to get. And after you're in, it's up to you to stay. Have you found a way into a career in politics? How has it defined you? Are you having second thoughts about pursuing a career in politics? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Co-authors and Hill veterans Amos Sneed and Jamie Harrison stay with us. Amos Sneed is co-founder of FamousDC.com, and Jamie Harrison is associate chair and counselor for the Democratic National Committee. Let's go right to the phones now with Mike joining us in Madison with a question. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
What is your question? What are your thoughts here?
Well, if I would like to try to work at the Hill, where I have to stay there, how long? I live in Madison. I'd like to keep my roots in Madison, but I don't want to go there forever. How many times would I be able to come back and forth, and who pays for that travel?
So, Mike, you're looking at relocation or not. How much of a commitment do you have to make to D.C.? Amos, go ahead.
So a lot of the advice I give to young folks who come into Washington or people who are looking to make that transition, they'll still have written on their resume their home address in Wisconsin. And usually what that does is when you're interviewing in these offices on the Hill, they kind of cast it aside because they think, oh, my gosh, this person is not in Washington. He or she's going to have to move here. We're going to have to wait on their transition. So my advice would be if you're looking for a career on Capitol Hill in Washington, I would prepare to make that move permanently. However, Washington's not the only place you can get involved in politics. I mean, if you are looking to get involved, you can go to any campaign office, state races, county races, federal races, and you can walk in and say, I support this candidate. I'm here to volunteer. How do I help? I'm going to say 99 times out of 100, they're going to help you come in because they're constantly looking for volunteers. So if you're looking to Washington, I would say you want to move full time. But as we outline in the book Climbing the Hill, Washington is not the only place you can get involved in politics.
Do you have to be a 20-something just starting out, or is it possible even to make a mid-career transition into a career in politics?
You see a lot of, again, we talked about the age on Capitol Hill, and you see a lot, like an influx of young people come into Washington beginning their career here, but that is not the only tried and true example. There are many different entry points into a career in politics. Jamie, anything to add there? Anything I'm leaving out?
Yeah. Amos, in the book Climbing a Hill, one of the we highlight a number of superstars in the public policy arena. One of them was one of my former colleagues, Elizabeth Mora, who she started off her career as a TV anchor and decided that she wanted to become a comms director, a communications director on Capitol Hill. And so mid-career, you know, she had an established career in TV and decided that she wanted to do communications with a public policy bent. And so she made that transition mid-career. So there are definitely many stories of people coming from the nonprofit world, from military, who all decide that they want to engage in public policy and then come to Capitol Hill. And again, Amos is right. We also have another chapter in the book, Climbing the Hill, about alternate routes, that you don't have to just go to Washington, D.C. Your state house, your governor's mansion, your local mayor. You have all of these places where you can really go and make a difference in public policy.
Jamie, I want to turn the focus for a moment to looking at your reputation for being aware that people who work on Capitol Hill and lawmakers, both, especially lawmakers, are under the microscope. Most recently, we've seen it tied to Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, a racist photograph involving blackface. And there are scores of other examples. How should political aspirants navigate this landscape and think about their past and their reputation?
Yeah, you know, your reputation is really, really important. I remember growing up, again, poor kid in South Carolina, and my grandfather, who didn't have much but was probably one of the most decent people I've ever met in my life, and he said, listen, Jamie, even when the money runs out, you have your name and your reputation, and that's the most important thing to you. And he said, guard it with all that you have. And that always stuck with me, and I think it's a good lesson in politics. You just got to be aware of the things that you do, the places you put yourself, the situations you put yourself in, because if you're involved in politics, it could be that one of those situations or things comes back up to haunt you. One of the things that we encourage young staff in the book, Capitol Hill, Climbing the Hill, is about guarding their reputation and making sure that they understand that the things that they do have repercussions not only for themselves but also for their bosses, the people that they work for. You know, you have too many drinks and you get in a car and you drive and you get caught driving and you get a DUI. You know, they're political reporters who are following, you know, the police reports to see who's actually, you know, getting charged with different things or getting caught. And those things could come back to haunt you and again, your boss. So it's very, very important to understand that people are always watching. People are looking at you. And with these positions, they're so important, they're so powerful, and there's so much of the public trust tied into them that you need to make sure that you never do anything that betrays that trust.
Well, Amos, a big part of the college experience are these internships, lots of interns on Capitol Hill. And I was laughing at the point of the book where you say that many of these young staffers, they go out at night, they're still wearing their badges so that they can kind of show who they are. They have, you know, just be able to show who they are, who they work for. And even if it is in just opening mail, how important are internships in the world of politics?
Kate, you have done your research. This is very impressive. Thank you for spending as much time as you did with the book. I do believe Washington is a town that runs on information and relationships. And the internships, you are going to learn some skills in the office, how the congressional office works. But what you're really doing is you're impressing everyone around you of how hard you work. And how you're the lowest person in the office, and you're the first one there, and you're staying late. I mean, Jamie has a story that he interned in Mr. Clyburn's office, and then when he did such a good job as an intern, when you think nobody is paying attention, that he later got a call back from the office when they had a leadership spot open because they remembered how Jamie worked in that office when he was an intern. So if there's anyone looking into this, and we like to think that our book, Climbing the Hill, makes for a great gift for college graduates or people that are interested in politics, high school graduates, because you start thinking about your internships there. And so they are important. You can do it without them. But I think the real importance of the internships as you're beginning your career are those connections you make and the opportunity you get to show everyone around you of how hard you can work.
Well, Jamie, I want you to weigh in here. There are a lot of people vying for these internships, these precious internships. A lot of them don't pay anything. And so not only are these college students having to find a way to Washington, but they also have to figure out how to live in Washington. Are there any tips on how to do this, how to be able to afford an internship and then stand out in a crowded field?
Yeah. So listen, there's been some movement in terms of the payment for internships on Capitol Hill. So for the first time, Congress, I think last session, Amy's correct me if I'm wrong, approved an appropriations so that now Capitol Hill offices can pay for some of the internship opportunities during the summer. And so I think we'll see some of that this summer. And then there are a number of organizations out there, and in the end of our book, we listed a lot of the organizations that have paid internship programs or paid fellowship programs. I participated in the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation internship, which came along with a stipend. They assisted us with transportation to Washington, D.C. And then there are other internships that even include housing or assistance with housing as well. At the DNC, where I'm the associate chair, last year was the first year that we also appropriated money for the internships in Washington, D.C. at the Democratic National Committee, because we wanted to make sure that everybody got the opportunity to really enjoy and get the experience of working in D.C. and seeing politics in all of its different phases.
Cody emailed and said, between my junior and senior years of college, I interned in D.C., and I would say the largest challenge is financially related. Interns are generally not paid, and the cost of living in the city is very high. Cody says, I lived in intern housing with a bunch of students from the University of Missouri, and their political science department offers a grant program for students who want to intern in D.C., thus limiting the financial obstacles. And Cody said, I would highly recommend working in D.C. It was a life changer for me. So, Amos, there are ways around the financial issues, it sounds.
I'm really happy Cody sent that in. And, you know, the one thing I would say, it is an expensive town to live in. I grew up in Northeast Alabama, and when I got to Washington, I mean, every time you turn around, you're spending money on things you didn't anticipate. But I, you know, going back to Cody's email, I bet he had an incredible time this summer living in that student housing with all of those other college students who are coming to Washington to try to make a difference. There are some organizations, as Jamie highlighted, College to Congress. It's an organization that helps different universities that don't have a program send students to Washington. There's Washington Intern Student Housing. I mean, there are ways around it. It is not cookie cutter, like you don't say, I got my internship and then everything else lines up. I mean, it's a competitive city, but there are some programs in place to help young people and students with that transition into Washington.
We're looking at what it takes to build a career in politics with co-authors of Climbing the Hill, Amos Sneed and Jamie Harrison. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Does this career path sound appealing to you or not? We'll get back to the conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about making a political career and how to do it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to a Pew Research Center study, about 6,800 journalists cover Congress. That's more than the entire Senate staff. No other industry is under the microscope as politics. And this conversation about a career in politics is also about building your reputation, being loyal, being respectful, ideals for any career. The book is Climbing the Hill, How to Build a Career in Politics and Make a Difference. And the co-authors, Jamie Harrison and Amos Sneed, stay with us for the conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you once considered politics. Have you been dissuaded from it, or are you more enthusiastic? Is there anything that would make you reconsider? 800-642-1234. Jamie, you make a lasting impression on what the job of the party whip is and how crucial this job is to get lawmakers of a party on the same page. And up until I read that moment in the book, I really didn't understand all that goes on in the background of a party whip. And I'm wondering if you could help us understand, take us behind the scenes in 2007 with the Hate Crimes Prevention Act and tell us about what the job is of this whip operation.
Yeah, so the whip operation is one of the, I always tell people, working for the whip operation is probably the best job I've ever had in my life and ever will have, because in essence, you are in the midst of everything. You are figuring out, you're testing the temperature of the members, and you're the first people who know whether or not a significant piece of legislation can pass on the floor of the House of Representatives or in the Senate. And so Amos and I were fortunate both to work for whips. And I was in charge of actually running the whip operation, making sure that we had the 218 votes to pass legislation. And many of your listeners will probably remember the tragedy of Matthew Shepard and how he lost his life. And so
in Wyoming, right.
In Wyoming, exactly. And you know, he was targeted because he was gay, and so that was not a protected issue under the hate crimes bill. And so we wanted to change that in that Congress. And so in the face of some obstacles, it was very, very difficult to get the 218 votes in order to pass that legislation. We did all kinds of things to try to move our members to pass it. And it wasn't until we actually brought Matthew's mom, Judy Shepard, to our whip meeting, and she sat and talked to the members of Congress, and she talked about her son and what it meant, and you know, hearing the tragedy in the news, and then the sheriff that investigated the tragedy also talked. And that was a moment that really moved a lot of members of Congress, and they could imagine their kids being subjected to these types of crimes. And so we were able to pass that legislation. And it was one of those moments in which I really went into that vote thinking that this is not going to pass. But because we were able to personalize it for so many members, and they could imagine the sorrow and the feeling that they could have if it impacted their kids or their loved ones, it was able to really pass. And now, you know, it's a celebrated part of how we protect people, and particularly people from the LGBTQ community.
Amos, what did you learn from whip operation and working behind the scenes on getting a party in lockstep? How did that impact you?
So Jamie and I had slightly different positions in these whip operations. So Jamie was working the floor for the Democratic whip, and I was working as a communications spokesperson for the Republican whip. So what I was able to do and what we were tasked with as the communication staff was, when you were having these behind-the-scenes conversations and you were having these whip vote counts, vote checks, how do you communicate that to the press, right? And if there's a big legislative package coming that may be a close vote, or that you already may have too many no's on it, you know, and the media starts poking around on that, and they want to write about it. And so our job was to take that inside information and communicate it to the press. And when I worked on the Hill, it was right when the internet was exploding, and you started seeing new journalists and new websites come into the mix. And what it really showed me was that at the time I was a 27-year-old kid from Alabama who was behind the scenes watching these conversations take place, talking with the journalists, talking with the reporters and the producers that were there. And then you would go home in the evening and you would watch what you talked about. Maybe you were a fly on the wall, was being broadcast on the evening news to the rest of the United States. And it, for me to see that take place and to see how that goes and to see that if you work hard enough, you can find your way into those rooms, was a real reason of why Jamie Harrison and I came together to write Climbing the Hill, so that we can encourage the next generation to continue on that journey.
Well, Amos, as we look toward the internet and social media, other, you know, politicians have really leveraged social media, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez comes to mind here. How can politicians and the people who are working behind the scenes use social media to their advantage?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, right? I think your advantage is you can connect directly with your constituents, directly with your home district, directly with your home state. Now, on the other side, though, it has allowed social media and the internet and the rise of digital politics in this country has really enabled people to only surround themselves with people who think like them. And what it's happened is it's pushed everybody to their ideological right, their ideological left. Everybody runs to their corner and puts on their red hat or their blue hat. And I think social media is continuing to drive that. And so what Jamie and I are trying to do is we're trying to light a spark here. We want to show everyone, hey, this is not just what you see on MSNBC and Fox News in the evening. There are actually people working together in Washington who came here for good reasons to make a difference. And so that's what we're trying to do here. I do think, you know, you bring up AOC, watching some of these members who have bigger Twitter followings than some of the, you know, national broadcast media outlets, it's completely transformed how we communicate in our political system. And as a practitioner of it, it's just fun to watch and to be at that bleeding cutting edge of that.
Let's bring in a call now. Jim is joining us from River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hi, this is River Falls. I was curious, talking about how people get involved with that. When you talked about Alexandria Cortez, it seems like when you're talking about transformational politics, you bring people in the ground floor, like the Democratic National Committee. It's a pretty mainstream conservative type organization. And, you know, for transformational change and to do bigger things and really work for the constituents, it seems that it tries to move towards a much more conservative status than some of these people that believe that we need bigger changes and that it would prevent people from pushing for those changes.
Well, Jim, we're short on time, but I really want to get to the crux of what you want to ask here. How do you prevent just becoming a cog in the machine for a congressional office, Jamie? How do you stand out?
Yeah, the big thing is you just got to put your head down and work hard and just learn about how the police operates. And, you know, one of the lessons that I learned from my former boss, Jim Clyburn, who I talk about quite often in Climbing the Hill, is that the person or the people who understand the rules, who understand the process, and who gets the relationships are the folks who really get a true understanding of how Capitol Hill operates. Every member of Congress has a trigger. I call it a trigger, but it's how you get them to act or react to a certain thing. And every member of Congress is very different. There are some members of Congress who are policy-oriented. There are some that are politically oriented. There are some that are constituent service-oriented. And so it's important for you to understand what type of member, if you're working on the Hill, what type of member that you are working for, or if you are going to be an advocate to the Hill, to understand the type of member that you are going to advocate to understand how you get that person to really act in the manner in which you want them to. And that's the magic of Capitol Hill, is figuring out that puzzle in order to really affect change and make a difference.
Jamie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Amos, thank you.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Jamie Harrison is Associate Chair and Counselor for the Democratic National Committee. Amos Sneed, co-founder of FamousDC.com. They're co-authors of Climbing the Hill, How to Build a Career in Politics and Make a Difference. Just ahead, while February 14th is generally associated with romantic love, we look at all of its varieties with a relationship columnist. She takes us through some of her most asked questions. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.